probably seen his series of articles reviewing books on the crisis in the New York Review of Books.
Bob, thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you all for coming. Thank you all for staying. I very much agree with many of the points made by my colleagues, who I know very well. In general, I agree with the idea that we've lived off asset inflation for a long time. But I also have comments to make that are in some disagreement with what they're talking about. Let me tell you the few points I want to make. They begin with a macroeconomic point of view. Understandably, I often write about that myself. In fact, my last piece in the New York Review of Books talked about the dangers of thinking that all we have to do is go back to a pre-2007 economy and all will be well. In fact, that's mostly what people are talking about at the moment. But let me make a few points. People think mass delusion, quote-unquote, occurs and recurs all the time. In fact, Joe Nocera, in reviewing this book, which I actually think is pretty good, this new financial crisis book from the FCIC, he talked about it's having no bottom line. I think he's completely wrong on that. The source of the burst of the bubble and the deep recession, in my view, is Wall Street corruption enabled by remarkably irresponsible government. Finance doesn't work without government. In my view, economists did not predict this bubble, in fact, bursting, they predicted the housing bubble bursting. I don't know of more than two or three who understood how much finance was dependent on the housing situation and how deeply it could bring the economy down. There's a lack of significant micro analysis among economists. It wasn't a function of conservative economics. It was a function of what Tom calls neoliberal economics. Conservative economics would have recognized in the traditional sense, like Henry Simons or Frank Knight before Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, that incentives were awry and crazy. The Friedman revolution, in my view, is not a conservative economics revolution, but a neoliberal ideological revolution about reducing the size of government, pure and simple. That dominated our view. I'm not going to advocate conservative economics, don't worry, but I think it should be clear in our minds what was going on here. Financial regulations now proposed to prevent the next crisis, and I think Anwar and Tom alluded to this to some degree, are simply not adequate. We have to make the financial system work the way it's supposed to work, which is to provide capital to productive investment in America. It did not do that, and therefore seriously contributed to the weakness in the macro economy that was ongoing. Let me go to the beginning then. I do not believe this bubble and this burst was inevitable through some force of nature or historical argument. In fact, my book, Age of Greed, which, write this down, is out in May, takes as a firm principle that individuals are critical to history. History does not follow a predictable, natural, and ineluctable process. Call it anti-Tolstoyan, if you like, though Tolstoy, I have to admit, is one of my heroes. We had delusions, and some of this was alluded to before, time and again since Ronald Reagan was president. We had bubbles, that is to say. We had crises. The 1982 Mexican crisis. I'm going to repeat this because it's important, I think, to get this into our heads. The 82 Mexican crisis, the 87 stock market crash, the 89 SNL crash, the 1990 junk bond crash. We had a 1994 semi-crash and a Mexican crash when Alan Greenspan raised interest rates again. There were all kinds of failures on Wall Street. There were hearings in Congress and under the Clinton administration that went absolutely nowhere in creating new regulations. We had the 1997 East Asian crisis. We had the 1998 Russian and long-term capital management crisis. We had the cracking of the 2000 high-tech bubble in as I said, in 2000, the NASDAQ fell by 80%, just to remind you all. And then we had this rather long, relatively calm period of a housing bubble that did not burst until the housing bubble burst in 2006. The financial calamity did not occur until 2007 and 2008. We had crisis after crisis. It was a very unstable period, and yet we had nothing like what we just had in 2007 and 2008. Nothing like it. Why was that? In fact, we had nothing like it for 75 years since the early Great Depression. Afterwards, we thought we put in place government programs that would limit the kind of excesses and speculation that occurred and redirect finance to productive purposes. And in large part, for a long time it did. It started to become undone in not really even the 1970s, but in the late 60s, which I do talk about in my book with Walter Wriston at First National Citibank then, and then later Citibank, Citicorp, Citigroup. That particular organization runs through the history of this age of greed remarkably. It is there at every great moment. Its chief executives always preaching the value of the free market and then periodically being bailed out by the federal government or they would not be here. Even when they were bailed out, they went to their bad old ways. Under Sandy Weill in the early 2000s, they paid the biggest fines and had the largest litigation costs there were after the Enron and WorldCom scandals, and they still did outrageous things in the mortgage bubble. Let me get then to what I think we haven't discussed enough, the remarkable corruption of Wall Street under the aegis of Alan Greenspan with the help of Ronald Reagan, George I, Bill Clinton, significantly more than the others, and finally George W. Bush. The 1990s, I would argue, was the most corrupt decade in financial history since the 1920s. That is not a fact that sits clearly in our sense of history. We just don't have a sense of that. It didn't start in the 2000s. We had Michael Milken in the 1980s. We had Ivan Boesky. We had the SNLs and Charles Keating. We had the junk bond craze and the LBOs. By the 1990s, everybody in a significant Wall Street house, Wall Street law firm, accounting firm, and consultancy was somehow involved in corrupt, unethical, or at the very least, overtly dishonest behavior. They lied about the value of high technology stocks openly, and eventually they admitted it, lied to their investors because they were paid by the investment bankers if they sold the deal. Accounting fraud was widespread and remarkable, culminating in the Enron and WorldCom deals. But by, I think eventually there were 400 companies, don't hold me to this, 400 companies a year forced to redo their books. I may have that number off, but it was a very significant number. Accounting frauds, Wall Street fraud, under the table payments for the high tech, IPOs, the initial, thank you. That must be Mubarak. Mubarak went to sleep. Are we okay? They must have known that I have slightly jet lagged voice, so thank you. Now I can talk more naturally. There was all kinds of under the table IPO allocations that led to the IPO wave in the late 1990s. Investors were giving IPO allocations. Throughout this, there was almost no fraudulent case brought by the government. Almost no criminal investigation of significance in the 1990s. This environment led to the 2000s. The fines, I can't even remember. Sarbanes-Oxley, about which the business complained vociferously and angrily, was somewhat effective, but didn't stop them. What happened in the 2000s? Was it business as usual? Were there just bad mortgages made? The history of this period, the history of the development of mortgage-backed securities, has to go down as one of the most remarkably, call it innovation, that's certainly the great euphemism of the age. Financial innovation gets my wife crazy every time she hears it. It's financial chicanery for the most part. Of course, there are a couple of good innovations out there. Securitization could have been a good innovation. Securitization meant pooling those mortgages and making them into the equivalent of bonds. That's harder to do than it sounds, and we probably shouldn't bother to talk about it too much. Many of you know it already. Making them into bonds, so pension funds, individual investors, investment managers, municipal governments, and so forth, could buy these things. That meant a lot more money going into the mortgage market. That should have brought mortgage rates down and improved the rate of home ownership. To some degree, it did. It was, however, a mechanism that was given to abuse and eventual corruption, partly because of its complexity, partly because of the existence of computerized models, but mostly because government was not there to stop the natural, ever-enlarging greed of the men and women on Wall Street. The ultimate device, now there was the basic mortgage-backed security. You package 5,000 mortgages into a bond. There's an intervening step, 5,000 mortgages. You break those mortgages down. They're not necessarily subprime mortgages yet. Some of them might be dubious. You break them down so that first 80% of investors get all the interest income. It's very unlikely 20% of those mortgages will go bad, so that first 80%, the people who own those bonds, that tranche is rated AAA, and you go down from there, AAA, AA, BAA, and so forth. Eventually, there were 19, 20, 22 tranches in some of these things. Okay, that's pretty tricky in itself. That implies that default rates won't go up very, very much, but even if they go up some, at least the AAAs will be covered. Money started coming in. This got out of hand quickly. Eventually, people started making bad mortgage loans. The possibility of default went up, but it was forestalled by, yes, that mass delusion that housing was a secure bet and would keep going up. But then along came this device, the collateralized debt obligation. Now, this is a thing of beauty that even Albert Einstein told me he was jealous he didn't think of himself. Guess who thought of it, however? Michael Milken's group in the late 1980s used it for junk bonds. But the device was not to put mortgages themselves into a unit, but to put those mortgage bonds, those mortgage tranches, into another bond. In other words, those AAA tranches, BAA tranches, even low-rated tranches, would go into this collateralized debt obligation. And you could thereby change even fairly low-rated bonds into AAA securities. Now, here was the bloody trick, and this was really unbelievable. These collateralized debt obligations were filled with subprime mortgages, subprime mortgage tranches. And the ratings authorities and the subprime managers, the securitization managers, like Merrill Lynch, like Citigroup, like Goldman Sachs, and so on, they would devise these so that 80% of these subprime mortgages could be rated. These packages of subprime mortgages could be rated AAA, but they're subprime mortgages. They argued that because of diversification, because some were from the state of Washington and some were from the capital of the United States, Washington, D.C., some were from Austin, they wouldn't all go bad together. And therefore, 80% of these tranches would not go bad. And if you bought that particular bond, you'd be safe. AAA, super safe bonds. The trouble is that they were highly correlated. And it was obvious to people that once triple B started going bad in most in many parts of the country, other triple, I mean, once subprimes went bad, other subprimes would go bad at the same time. In fact, the structure of these CDOs was such that you didn't need a 15% default rate on subprime mortgages, which is what they eventually went to. You only needed a 6 or 7% default rate on these subprime mortgages, not to, merely to undermine the low-rated tranches, the triple Bs and so forth, but to undermine the AAA, tranches. Now, what happened? These guys, specifically, at Citigroup, Sandy Weill left, but he was still chairman emeritus in a way, run by Chuck Prince, his lawyer in charge. And I hope you don't mind my saying this, Chuck, if this gets on the YouTube, but well known as a sycophant. Stan O'Neill, who took over Merrill Lynch and said, we're not going to be a second-rate company anymore. We're going to make this company a first-rate company. And by the way, I'm going to make a lot of money in the meantime. Those two organizations led the way to start selling CDOs in 2005, 2006, and 2007, even as the housing market was already cracking. Now, why did they do that? I already said, in my view, personal greed. But you made a big fee every time you made one of those CDO sales. You made 1 to 2%. Some parts of it you made 0.1%. 0.1% on $1 billion is not bad for a day or two's worth. 1% is pretty darn good. 2% fabulous. Pretty soon, Citigroup and Merrill Lynch were writing more of these CDOs than the big-time CDO players, Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, and you know what happened to them. Things got really crazy. So here we are in 2007. This very smart economist at the Federal Reserve, neoclassical to a man, said, we can contain the subprime mortgage problem. In fact, there were 13 or 14 trillion mortgages, worth of mortgages in America around this time. Guess what the losses on subprimes were? No more than $300 billion in subprimes going down. They weren't the majority. In 1 or 2 years, they were the majority of those rates. $300 billion, however, supported a pyramid of debt that nobody understood, including the Federal Reserve economists. What I find pretty, what I find extremely upsetting is that the Federal Reserve was the only organization that had the authority and perhaps, with an emphasis on perhaps, the know-how to figure that out, and they never bothered to do it. Bernanke and his staff, and many of you know them, they are smart people, said $300 billion in losses, we can handle that. In fact, it supported a couple of $1 trillion worth of bad debt. That is what brought that market down. It was not merely the bursting of a very bad housing bubble. In fact, I don't think I should verify this with Shiller, testified before Schumer, and one of his Schumer's aides told me, Shiller, and you know Shiller, the Yale economist, the Shiller Case-Shiller Housing Index, who is very wary about the housing market and thought there would certainly be a crash, was asked, how would it affect the real economy? And he said, it's manageable. We can handle that, he told the Schumer Committee. I think it was 2005. I think that, by and large, reflected the analysis of economists all along. What happened in the end, and the reason just to reiterate why that happened, was the debt structure built on these mortgages was simply not understood. You know, they got synthetic CDOs. I mean, you can go on about this forever. But the real beauty of synthetic CDOs is you didn't need mortgages. You didn't need any mortgages behind them. At least with CDOs, you need packages of real mortgages, however bad they were. CDOs or synthetic CDOs were basically bets based on credit default swaps about, and they referenced mortgages. There were no real mortgages around. So you could write a lot more debt than there were mortgages. There were CDOs of CDOs. The triple B rated tranches were kind of hard to sell. Who bought them? Other CDO managers who were trying to create CDOs and sell them to other people. One more step in this is important to understand. The only reason Citigroup and Merrill and some of the others, UBS in Europe, could sell these after a while is if they bought the tranches themselves. They had to buy substantial portions of these tranches themselves. They had enormous assets on the books. So did AIG, by the way. AIG, the insurance company. As you know, sold a lot of these credit default swaps. They keep saying they stopped in 2005, but it turns out this is one of the interesting things about this book. There is information in this book that's very useful. They kept selling them well into about mid-2006 and really didn't stop fully till 2007. But they also bought a heck of a lot of these dubious CDO tranches. When Merrill and Citigroup finally reported those losses that Bob Rubin said he did not hear about or know about until they were reported, the guy in the executive committee, it just makes you dizzy. And he's still justifying his view these days. They were mostly those bad assets they had. They also did other things. They sold liquidity puts. It was quite unbelievable. And it's very possible, because they hid a lot of those assets in structured investment vehicles, what they did may have been illegal. By hiding them in structured investment vehicles, they didn't require capital requirements against them. So, So basically, this was, as Bob said, a very highly leveraged situation. The Federal Reserve, I do not believe Geithner had any idea what was going on. And I have spoken to people at the New York Fed. They have invited me. They are red-faced with shame, but they still make a good living. And they say they did not analyze these CDOs. It's quite remarkable. So what was going on here? Why didn't they analyze them? That's a long story. And Tom and Anwar have told some of that story. In my view, there was a serious ideological turn in America in the 1970s and the pain of the stagflation of that era. And then the people in charge became fairly extreme ideologues. I doubt ever, we can go over the statements of Alan Greenspan, remarkable in retrospect, time and again, in encouraging people to buy, adjusted rate mortgages. Yeah? I thought I'd been talking for about 5 minutes. Okay, adjustable rate mortgages, telling people that we didn't have to regulate, derivatives, telling it over and over again. As Tom and Anwar were pointing out, in 1998 he told President Clinton he has never seen an economy as strong as it was then, even as the savings rate was coming down, even as we had those bubbles. Let me just go over that very quickly, then, the history of these financial escapades. And what I think has seriously undermined the American economy in a more micro way. In the mid-1970s, the Reagan administration allowed Walter Wriston to begin the privatization of the flow of petrodollars when OPEC raised oil prices. I blame Reagan for everything. Nixon Ford allowed him to recycle. They lent like crazy to Latin America, as you know. It was not a bad loan for a short period of time because of inflation. Commodities prices were going up. Even Volcker, who was skeptical of it, was surprised that those loans did okay. They did okay only until Volcker broke the back of inflation, and then we had the first Mexican crisis. And the banks in America carried bad debt because they just wanted to hide it for the next 8 or 9 years until George H.W. Bush, in fact, and the Brady bonds. An enormous waste of capital. Government should not have relinquished its responsibility in that regard. In the 1980s, we know about taxes, deficits, military spending, the Reagan revolution, quote unquote. But we had the most unintelligent deregulation bill of all time, and that is really something, saying something. Saint-Germain, which basically allowed the SNLs to invest money that they got from their depositors anywhere they wanted to, up to 40% or 50%. That money, remember, was insured by the FSLIC, like the FDIC. The government let these guys buy golf courses, amusement park, I don't know, you name it, they bought it, and junk bonds. An amazing waste of money in that period. Michael Milken financed leverage buyouts and takeovers with junk bonds, remember, with the help of the interest rate deduction. The takeover movement, it would be very hard to argue, though there are plenty of people who try, even at UCLA, that it had productive results. I think the evidence that's now widely accepted is those takeovers, on balance, were bad, and it was not a productive use of capital. In the 1990s, we had the fantasies of high technology and the outright deceit. There was outright deceit in high technology, but outright deceit in the telecoms. Hundreds of millions, if not, hundreds of billions, if not $1 trillion or more, of wasted capital not productively spent. And then we have the absurd housing boom. How much bad money did America waste on absurd fantasy investments? While these guys got rich and Washington looked the other way based on ideology. I should stop there. I just want to give you one number, though. In the Moody's ratings, and there are all kinds of culprits here, Moody's ratings downgraded, I don't even have it here. In any case, they downgraded almost all the tranches, the AAAs and the BBs, in 2006 and 2007. Three-quarters of them they downgraded from AAA, or at least investment grade, to junk in 1 year. That's how wrong they were. Were they wrong because they were unintelligent or overly gullible? No. They were making a fortune also. We had very bad incentives. We had untransparent markets in CDSs. We had opaque CDOs. The list goes on. That's why I say it wasn't conservative economics at work here. Conservatives would have been upset because the market principles were undermined. And it was more than that. It was the inevitability, and I do believe in the Minsky model to some degree, the inevitability of over-speculation, which is ignored. You know, Kindleberger, and I'm going to stop here, Kindleberger in his Mania's book wrote that both Friedman certainly, and he was writing at a time when Friedman's star was very high and ascending, and Keynes, and that's the only reason he equated the two in this particular instance. Both Friedman and Keynes missed the importance of financial markets and financial over-speculation in their analyses. And I think that eventually that influenced, indeed, even Keynesian economists afterwards. The Kindlebergers, the Minskys, and the John Kenneth Galbraiths have talked about this subsequently. The upshot is we have way too much debt to count on rapid economic growth. We have to reorient investment into productive uses. And I totally agree with Anwar and Tom. We need demand-led economic growth, about which we're doing some economic research with the help of Rockefeller. We need wages to Detroit. Yeah, Rockefeller. I should have said the Rockefeller. Whatever the heck it's called, the Rockefeller Foundation. We need wages to drive growth, not a supply-side neoliberal model. I better stop there. Thanks very much.
Okay. So I believe there's coffee across the hall. It's about 12 minutes to 4. We've had three speakers, so why don't we come back for discussion? Just a little bit. I'm going to start the next session. Start the next session at 4. So please have your break, and we'll come back so we can have people still here to have some discussion. Very good. What?
I want the first question.
What do you give me for that? Oh. I hear that people have been doing very well.
I couldn't try to work at the CDs.
I thought there were.
I heard about these three tranches, and that essentially they could sell the third and the first, but the middle one was motivated.
Yeah, I think that's quite a bit. The bottom one, there were eventually a lot more than three, but the bottom one, they're so to the head.
Yeah.
And the reason they could take risks is they hedged the CBS. And they led, like crazy, they borrowed like crazy to take these things and hedge them.
Hi. Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, of course.
Hi, Paul Boyle. It seemed to me that if they had to go through all the tranches, which was the abuse of leverage, was the disassociation between the borrower and the lender, right? I mean, they would.
No, oh, yeah, well, the idea that you didn't have to worry about
corrupt
yeah,
in itself.
Yeah, the.
Well, how do you define corrupt, by the way?
You must be a philosopher.
A political theorist.
I think if you misrepresent what you're doing, corrupt, it makes the same thing in the law. So I think they misrepresented it.
I'm doing good.
But I don't know. The fraud law is good enough to deal with that. We're going to have lunch tomorrow with the UCLA law professor. Adam Wilkin, you know who he is?
No, I don't.
But anyway, I hope to help you out a little.
I'm from Orange County, so I'm a bit out of touch with UCLA proper.
Nice to see you. Thank you for coming and listening.
Hi, I'm Matt Drennan. I want to introduce myself.
I am
economics, and marginal utility.
Oh, yeah.
And when I wrote it,